An animal he's allergic to? She jerked her thumb. Puppy goes back in the barrel.
Can you give me till Sunday morning?
Bob wasn't sure how it was the words left his mouth, since he couldn't remember formulating them or even thinking them. The girl eyed him carefully.
You're not just saying it? 'Cause I shit you not, he ain't picked up by Sunday noon. He's back out that door.
Sunday, then.
Bob said the words with a conviction he actually felt.
Sunday, definitely.
Yeah?
She smiled, and it was a spectacular smile, and Bob saw that the face behind the pockmarks was as spectacular as the smile, wanting only to be seen. She touched the puppy's nose with her index finger.
Yeah.
Bob felt crazed. He felt light as a communion wafer.
Yeah.
At Cousin Marv's, where he tended bar 12 to 10, Wednesday through Sunday, he told Marv all about it. Most people called Marv Cousin Marv out of habit, something that went back to grade school, though no one could remember how. But Marv actually was Bob's cousin, on his mother's side. Cousin Marv had run a crew in the late 80s and early 90s. It had been primarily comprised of guys with interests in the loaning and subsequent debt repayal side of things, though Marv never turned his nose down at any paying proposition, because he believed, to the core of his soul, that those who failed to diversify were always the first to collapse when the wind turned. Like the dinosaurs, he'd say to Bob, when the cavemen came along and invented arrows. Picture the cavemen, he'd say, firing away, and the tyrannosauruses all gucked up in the oil puddles. A tragedy so easily averted. Marv's crew hadn't been the toughest crew, or the smartest, or the most successful operating in the neighborhood. Not even close. But for a while they got by. Other crews kept nipping at their heels, though, and except for one glaring exception, they'd never been ones to favor violence. Pretty soon, they had to make the decision to yield to crews a lot meaner than they were, or duke it out. They took door number one. Marv's income derived from running his bar as a drop. In the New World Order, a loose collective of Chechen, Italian, and Irish hard guys, no one wanted to get caught with enough merch or enough money for a case to go federal. So they kept it out of their offices and out of their homes, and they kept it on the move. About every 2-3 weeks, drops were made at Cousin Marv's, among other establishments. You sat on the drop for a night, two at the most, before some beer truck driver showed up with the weekend's password and hauled everything back out on a dolly, like it was a stack of empty kegs, took it away in a refrigerated semi. The rest of Marv's income derived from being a fence, one of the best in the city, but being a fence in their world, or a drop bar operator for that matter, was like being a mailroom clerk in the straight world. If you were still doing it after 30, it was all you'd ever do. For Bob, it was a relief. He liked being a bartender, and he'd hated that one time they'd had to come heavy. Marv, though, Marv still waited for the golden train to arrive on the golden tracks, take him away from all this. Most times, he pretended to be happy, but Bob knew that the things that haunted Marv were the same things that haunted Bob, the shitty things you did to get ahead. Those things laughed at you if your ambitions failed to amount to much. A successful man could hide his past. An unsuccessful man sat in his. That morning, Marv was looking a hair on the mournful side, lighting one camel while the previous one still smoldered. So Bob tried to cheer him up by telling him about his adventure with the dog. Marv didn't seem too interested, and Bob found himself saying, "You had to be there," so much, he eventually shut up about it. Marv said,
"Rumor is we're getting the Super Bowl drop."
"No shit."
If true, an enormous if, this was huge. They worked on commission, 0.5% of the drop. A Super Bowl drop? It would be like 0.5% of Exxon. Nadia's scar flashed in Bob's brain, the redness of it, the thick, ropey texture.
They send extra guys to protect it, you think?
Marv rolled his eyes.
Why? 'Cause people are just lining up to steal from coked-up Chechnyans?
Chechens,
Bob said.
But they're from Chechnya.
Bob shrugged.
I think it's how you don't call people from Ireland Irelandians.
Marv scowled.
Whatever. It means all this hard work we've been doing, it's paid off. Like how Toyota did it, making friends and influencing people.
Bob kept quiet. If they ended up being the drop for the Super Bowl, it was because someone figured out no feds deemed them important enough to be watched. But in Marv's fantasies, the crew, long since dispersed to straight jobs, jail, or worse, Connecticut, could regain its glory days, even though those days had lasted about as long as a swatch. It never occurred to Marv that one day they'd come take everything he had, the fence, the money, and merch he kept in the safe and back. Hell, the bar, probably, just because they were sick of him hanging around, looking at them with needy expectation. It had gotten so every time he talked about the people he knew, the dreams he had, Bob had to resist the urge to reach for the 9mm they kept beneath the bar and blow his own brains out. Not really, but close, sometimes.
Man, Marv could wear you out.
A guy stuck his head in the bar, late 20s, but with white hair, a white goatee, a silver stud in his ear. He dressed like most kids these days, like shit. Pre-ripped jeans, slovenly t-shirt, under a faded hoodie, under a wrinkled wool topcoat. He didn't cross the threshold, just craned his head in, the cold day pouring in off the sidewalk behind him.
"Help you?" Bob asked.
The guy shook his head, kept staring at the gloomy bar like it was a crystal ball.
"Mind shutting the door?" Marv didn't look up. "Cold out there."
"You serve Zima?"
The guy's eyes flew around the bar, up and down, left to right. Marv looked up now.
"Who the fuck would we serve it to, Moesha?"
The guy raised an apologetic hand.
"My bad."
He left, and the warmth returned with the closing of the door. Marv said,
"You know that kid?"
Bob shook his head.
"Might have seen him around, but I can't place him."
"He's a fucking nutbag. Lives in the next parish. Probably why you don't know him. You're old school that way, Bob. Somebody didn't go to parochial school with you. It's like they don't exist."
Bob couldn't argue. When he'd been a kid, your parish was your country. Everything you needed and needed to know was contained within it. Now that the archdiocese had shuttered half the parishes to pay for the crimes of the kid-diddler priests, Bob couldn't escape the fact that those days of parish dominion, long dwindling, were gone. He was a certain type of guy, of a certain half-generation, an almost generation, and while there were still plenty of them left, they were older, grayer, they had smoker's coughs, they went in for checkups and never checked back out.
"That kid?"
Marv gave Bob a bump of his eyebrows.
"They say he killed Richie Whelan back in the day."
"They say?"
"They do."
"Well, then."
They sat in silence for a bit. Snow dust blew past the window in the high-pitched breeze. The street signs and window panes rattled, and Bob thought how winter lost any meaning the day you last rode a sled. Any meaning but gray. He looked into the unlit sections of the barroom. The shadows became hospital beds, stooped old widowers shopping for sympathy cards, empty wheelchairs. The wind howled a little sharper.
"This puppy, right?"
Bob said.
"He's got paws the size of his head. Three are brown, but one's white with these little peach-colored spots over the white. And
this thing cook," Marv said. "Clean the house? I mean, it's a fucking dog."
"Yeah, but it was..."
Bob dropped his hands. He didn't know how to explain.
"You know that feeling you get sometimes on a really great day? Like the Pats dominate and you took the over, or they cook your steak just right up the blarney, or you just feel good? Like,
Bob found himself waving his hands again.
Good?
Marv gave him a nod and a tight smile, went back to his racing sheet. On Sunday morning, Nadia brought the puppy to his car as he idled in front of her house. She handed it through the window and gave them both a little wave. He looked at the puppy sitting on his seat, and fear washed over him. What does it eat? When does it eat? Housebreaking. How do you do that? How long does it take? He'd had days to consider these questions. Why were they only occurring to him now? He hit the brakes and reversed the car a few feet. Nadia, one foot on her bottom step, turned back. He rolled down the passenger window, craned his body across the seat until he was peering up at her.
"I don't know what to do," he said. "I don't know anything."
At a supermarket for pets, Nadia picked out several chew toys, told Bob he'd need them if he wanted to keep his couch. "Shoes," she told him. "Keep your shoes hidden from now on, up on a high shelf." They bought vitamins, for a dog, and a bag of puppy food she recommended, telling him the most important thing was to stick with that brand from now on. "Change a dog's diet," she warned. "You'll get piles of diarrhea on your floor." They got a crate to put him in when Bob was at work. They got a water bottle for the crate and a book on dog training written by monks who were on the cover, looking hardy and not real monkish, big smiles. As the cashier rang it all up, Bob felt a quake rumble through his body, a momentary disruption as he reached for his wallet. His throat flushed with heat. His head felt fizzy. And only as the quake went away and his throat cooled and his head cleared, and he handed over his credit card to the cashier, did he realize, in the sudden disappearance of the feeling, what the feeling had been, for a moment, maybe even a succession of moments, and none sharp enough to point to as the cause, he'd been happy.
"So, thank you," she said
when he pulled up in front of her house.
"What? No. Thank you. Please. Really. Thank you."
She said,
"This little guy, he's a good guy. He's going to make you proud, Bob."
He looked down at the puppy, sleeping on her lap now, snoring slightly.
"Do they do that? Sleep all the time?"
"Pretty much. Then they run around like loonies for about 20 minutes. Then they sleep some more. And poop. Bob, man, you gotta remember that. They poop and pee like crazy. Don't get mad. They don't know any better. Read the monk book. It takes time, but they figure out soon enough not to do it in the house."
"What's soon enough?"
2 months.
She cocked her head.
"Maybe 3. Be patient, Bob."
"Be patient," he repeated.
"And you too,"
she said to the puppy as she lifted it off her lap. He came awake, sniffing, snorting. He didn't want her to go.
"You both take care."
She let herself out and gave Bob a wave as she walked up her steps, then went inside. The puppy was on its haunches, staring up at the window like Nadia might reappear there. It looked back over his shoulder at Bob. Bob could feel its abandonment. He could feel his own. He was certain they'd make a mess of it, him and this throwaway dog. He was sure the world was too strong.
"What's your name?" he asked the puppy. "What are we going to call you?"
The puppy turned his head away, like, bring the girl back. First thing it did was take a shit in the dining room. Bob didn't even realize what it was doing at first. It started sniffing, nose scraping the rug, and then it looked up at Bob with an air of embarrassment. And Bob said,
"What?"
And the dog dumped all over the corner of the rug. Bob scrambled forward, as if he could stop it, push it back in, and the puppy bolted, left droplets on the hard wood as it scurried into the kitchen.
Bob said, "No, no, it's okay,"
although it wasn't. Most everything in the house had been his mother's, largely unchanged since she'd purchased it in the 50s. That was shit, excrement, in his mother's house, on her rug, her floor. In the seconds it took him to reach the kitchen, the puppy had left a piss puddle on the linoleum. Bob almost slipped in it. The puppy was sitting against the fridge, looking at him, tensing for a blow, trying not to shake. And it stopped Bob. It stopped him even as he knew the longer he left the shit on the rug, the harder it would be to get out. Bob got down on all fours. He felt the sudden return of what he'd felt when he first picked it out of the trash, something he'd assumed had left with Nadia. Connection. He suspected they might have been brought together by something other than chance. He said, "Hey," barely above a whisper. "Hey, it's all right." So slowly, he extended his hand, and the puppy pressed itself harder against the fridge. But Bob kept the hand coming, and gently lay his palm on the side of the animal's face. He made soothing sounds. He smiled at it. "It's okay," he repeated, over and over. He named it Cassius because he'd mistaken it for a boxer, and he liked the sound of the word. It made him think of Roman legions, proud jaws, honor. Nadia called him Cash. She came around after work sometimes, and she and Bob took it on walks. He knew something was a little off about Nadia, the dog being found so close to her house, and her lack of surprise or interest in that fact was not lost on Bob. But was there anyone, anywhere on this planet, who wasn't a little off? More than a little, most times. Nadia came by to help with the dog, and Bob, who hadn't known much friendship in his life, took what he could get. They taught Cassius to sit and lie down and paw and roll over. Bob read the entire monk book and followed its instructions. The puppy had his rabies shot and was cleared of any cartilage damage to his ear. "Just a bruise," the vet said, "just a deep bruise." He grew fast. Weeks passed without Cassius having an accident, but Bob still couldn't be sure whether that was luck or not, and then, on Super Bowl Sunday, Cassius used one paw on the back door. Bob let him out and then tore through the house to call Nadia. He was so proud he felt like yodeling, and he almost mistook the doorbell for something else. A kettle, he thought, still reaching for the phone. The guy on the doorstep was thin. Not weak thin, hard thin. As if whatever burned inside of him burned too hot for fat to survive. He had blue eyes so pale they were almost gray. His silver hair was cropped tight to his skull, as was the goatee that clung to his lips and chin. It took Bob a second to recognize him. The kid who'd stuck his head in the bar 5-6 weeks back asked if they served Zima. The kid smiled and extended his hand.
"Mr. Saganowski?"
Bob shook the hand.
"Yes?"
"Bob Saganowski?"
The man shook Bob's large hand with his small one, and there was a lot of power in the grip.
"Yeah?"
"Eric Deeds, Bob."
The kid let go of his hand.
"I believe you have my dog."
In the kitchen, Eric Deeds said,
"Hey, there he is," he said. "That's my guy,"
he said.
"He got big,"
he said.
"The size of him."
Cassius slinked over to him, even climbed up on his lap when Eric, unbidden, took a seat at Bob's kitchen table and patted his inner thigh twice. Bob couldn't even say how it was Eric Deeds talked his way into the house. He was just one of those people had a way about him, like cops and teamsters. He wanted in, he was coming in.
"Bob," Eric Deeds said, "I'm going to need him back."
He had Cassius in his lap and was rubbing his belly. Bob felt a prick of envy as Cassius kicked his left leg, even though a constant shiver, almost a palsy, ran through his fur. Eric Deeds scratched under Cassius's chin. The dog kept his ears and tail pressed flat to his body. He looked ashamed, his eyes staring down into their sockets.
"'"
Bob reached out and lifted Cassius off Eric's lap, plopped him down on his own, scratched behind his ears.
Cash is mine.
The act was between them now, Bob lifting the puppy off Eric's lap without any warning, Eric looking at him for just a second like, the fuck was that all about? His forehead narrowed, and it gave his eyes a surprised cast, as if they'd never expected to find themselves on his face. In that moment, he looked cruel, the kind of guy, if he was feeling sorry for himself, took a shit on the whole world. Cash, he said. Bob nodded as Cassius's ears unfurled from his head, and he licked Bob's wrist.
Short for Cassius, that's his name. What did you call him?
Called him Dog, mostly. Sometimes Hound.
Eric Deeds glanced around the kitchen, up at the old circular fluorescent in the ceiling, something going back to Bob's mother. Hell, Bob's father, just before the first stroke, around the time the old man had become obsessed with paneling. Paneled the kitchen, the living room, the dining room. Would have paneled the toilet if he could have figured out how.
Bob said, "You beat him."
Eric reached into his shirt pocket. He pulled out a cigarette and popped it in his mouth. He lit it, shook out the match, tossed it on Bob's kitchen table.
"You can't smoke in here."
Eric considered Bob with a level gaze and kept smoking.
"I beat him?"
"Yeah."
So what?"
Eric flicked some ash on the floor.
"I'm taking the dog, Bob."
Bob stood to his full height. He held tight to Cassius, who squirmed a bit in his arms and nipped at the flat of his hand. If it came to it, Bob decided, he'd drop all 6 feet 3 inches and 290 pounds of himself on Eric Deeds, who couldn't weigh more than 170. Not now, not just standing there. But if Eric reached for Cassius, well then. Eric Deeds blew a stream of smoke at the ceiling.
"I saw you that night. I was feeling bad, you know, about my temper. So I went back to see if the hound was really dead or not, and I watched you pluck him out of the trash."
"I really think you should go."
Bob pulled his cell from his pocket and flipped it open.
"I'm calling 911.
Eric nodded.
"I've been in prison, Bob. Mental hospitals. I've been a lot of places. I'll go again. Don't mean a thing to me. Though I doubt they'd prosecute even me for fucking up a dog. I mean, sooner or later. You gotta go to work or get some sleep."
"What is wrong with you?"
Eric held out his hands.
"Pretty much everything. And you took my dog."
"You tried to kill it."
Eric said, "Nah." Shook his head like he believed it.
"You can't have the dog."
"I need the dog."
"No."
"I love that dog."
"No."
10,000.
"What?"
Eric nodded.
"I need 10 grand, by tonight. That's the price."
Bob gave it a nervous chuckle.
"Who has $10,000?
"You could find it."
"How could I poss-"
"Say that safe in Cousin Marv's office? You're a drop, Bob. You don't think half the neighborhood knows? So that might be a place to start."
Bob shook his head.
"Can't be done. Any money we get during the day goes through a slot at the bar. Ends up in the office safe, yeah, but that's on a time
lock. I know."
Eric turned on the couch, one arm stretched along the back of it.
"Goes off at 2 a.m. in case they decide they need a last-minute payout for something, who the fuck knows, but big. And you have 90 seconds to open and close it, or it triggers 2 silent alarms, neither of which goes off in a police station or a security company. Fancy that."
Eric took a hit off his cigarette.
"I'm not greedy, Bob. I just need stake money for something. I don't want everything in the safe, just 10 grand. You give me 10 grand, I'll disappear."
"This is ludicrous."
"So? It's ludicrous."
"You don't just walk into someone's life and..."
"That is life. Someone like me coming along when you're not looking."
Bob put Cassius on the floor, but made sure he didn't wander over to the other side of the table. He needn't have worried. Cassius didn't move an inch, sat there like a cement post, eyes on Bob. Eric Deeds said, "You're racing through all your options, but they're options for normal people in normal circumstances. I need my 10 grand tonight. If you don't get it for me, I'll take your dog. I licensed him. You didn't, because you couldn't. Then I'll forget to feed him for a while. One day, when he gets all yappy about it, I'll beat his head in with a rock or something. Look in my eyes and tell me which part I'm lying about, Bob." After he left, Bob went to his basement. He avoided it whenever he could, though the floor was white, as white as he'd been able to make it, whiter than it had ever been through most of its existence. He unlocked a cupboard over the old wash sink his father had often used after one of his adventures in paneling, and removed a yellow and brown Chock-Full-O-Nuts can from the shelf. He pulled 15,000 from it. He put 10 in his pocket and 5 back in the can. He looked around again at the white floor, at the black oil tank against the wall, at the bare bulbs. Upstairs he gave Cassius a bunch of treats. He rubbed his ears and his belly. He assured the animal that he was worth $10,000. Bob, 3 deep at the bar for a solid hour between 11 and midnight, looked through a sudden gap in the crowd and saw Eric sitting at the wobbly table under the Narragansett mirror. The Super Bowl was an hour over, but the crowd, drunk as shit, hung around. Eric had one arm stretched across the table, and Bob followed it, saw that it connected to something, an arm, Nadia's arm. Nadia's face stared back at Eric, unreadable. Was she terrified? Or something else? Bob, filling a glass with ice, felt like he was shoveling the cubes into his own chest, pouring them into his stomach and against the base of his spine. What did he know about Nadia, after all? He knew that he'd found a near-dead dog in the trash outside her house. He knew that Eric Deeds only came into his life after Bob had met her. He knew that her middle name, thus far, could be Lies of Omission. When he was 28, Bob had come into his mother's bedroom to wake her for Sunday Mass. He'd given her a shake, and she hadn't batted at his hand as she normally did. So he rolled her toward him, and her face was scrunched tight, her eyes, too, and her skin was curbstone gray. Sometime in the night, after Matlock and the 10 o'clock news, she'd gone to bed and woke to God's fist clenched around her heart. Probably hadn't been enough air left in her lungs to cry out. Alone in the dark, clutching the sheets, that fist clenching, her face clenching, her eyes scrunching, the terrible knowledge dawning that, even for you, it all ends, and right now. Standing over her that morning, imagining the last tick of her heart, the last lonely wish her brain had been able to form, Bob felt a loss unlike any he'd ever known or expected to know again. Until tonight, until now, until he learned what that look on Nadia's face meant. By 1:50, the crowd was gone, just Eric and Nadia, and an old, stringent, functioning alcoholic named Millie, who'd amble off to the assisted living place up on Pearl Street at 1:55 on the dot. Eric, who had been coming to the bar for shots of Powers for the last hour, pushed back from the table and pulled Nadia across the floor with him. He sat her on a stool, and Bob got a good look in her face finally, saw something he still couldn't fully identify. But it definitely wasn't excitement or smugness or the bitter smile of a victor. Maybe something worse than all of that, despair. Eric gave him an all-teeth smile and spoke through it softly.
"When's the old biddy pack it in?"
"A couple minutes."
"Where's Marv?"
"I didn't call him in."
"Why not?"
"Someone's gonna take the blame for this. I figured it might as well be me."
"How noble of—"
"How do you know her?"
Eric looked over at Nadia, hunched on the stool beside him. He leaned into the bar.
"We grew up on the same block."
"He give you that scar?"
Nadia stared at him.
Did he?
She gave herself the scar, Eric Deeds said.
You did? Bob asked her.
Nadia looked at the bar top.
I was pretty high.
Bob, Eric said, if you fuck with me, even in the slightest, it doesn't matter how long it takes me. I'll come back for her. And if you got any plans, like Eric doesn't walk back out of here plans, not that you're that type of guy, but Marv might be, you got any ideas in that vein, Bob, my partner on the Richie Whalen hit, he'll take care of you both.
Eric sat back as mean old Millie left the same tip she'd been leaving since Sputnik, a quarter, and slid off her stool. She gave Bob a rasp that was 10% vocal cords and 90% Virginia Slim's ultralight 100s.
Yeah, I'm off.
You take care, Millie.
She waved it away with a,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and pushed open the door. Bob locked it behind her and came back behind the bar. He wiped down the bar top. When he reached Eric's elbows, he said,
excuse me.
Go around. Bob wiped the rag in a half circle around Eric's elbows.
Who's your partner? Bob said.
Wouldn't be much of a threat if you knew who he was, would he, Bob?
But he helped you kill Richie Whalen?
Eric said, that's the rumor, Bob.
More than a rumor.
Bob wiped in front of Nadia, saw red marks on her wrists where Eric had yanked them. He wondered if there were other marks he couldn't see. Well, then, it's more than a rumor, Bob. So there you go.
There you go what?
There you go, Eric scowled. What time is it, Bob? Bob placed $10,000 on the bar.
You don't have to call me by my name all the time.
I will see what I can do about that, Bob. Eric thumbed the bills. What's this?
It's the $10,000 you wanted for cash.
Eric pursed his lips. All the same, let's look in the safe.
You sure? Bob said. I'm happy to buy him from you for $10,000.
How much for Nadia, though?
Oh, yeah, oh.
Bob thought about that new wrinkle for a bit, and poured himself a closing time shot of vodka. He raised it to Eric Deeds, and then drank it down.
You know, Marv used to have a problem with blow about 10 years ago.
I did not know that, Bob. Bob shrugged, poured them all a shot of vodka.
Yeah, Marv liked the coke too much, but it didn't like him back.
Eric drank Nadia's shot. Getting close to two here, Bob.
He was more of a loan shark then. I mean, he did some fence, but mostly he was a shark. There was this kid, into Marv for a shitload of money. Real hopeless case when it came to the dogs and basketball. Kind of kid could never pay back all he owed.
Eric drank his own shot. 157, Bob.
The thing, though, this kid, he actually hit on a slot at Mohegan. Hit for $22,000, which is just a little more than he owed Marv.
And he didn't pay Marv back, so you and Marv got all hard on him, and I'm supposed to learn?
No, no. He paid Marv. Paid him every cent. What the kid didn't know, though, was that Marv had been skimming. Because of the coke habit? And this kid's money was like manna from heaven, as long as no one knew it was from this kid. See what I'm saying?
Bob, it's fucking 1 minute to two. Sweat on Eric's lip.
Do you see what I'm saying? Bob asked. Do you understand the story?
Eric looked to the door to make sure it was locked. Fine, yeah. This kid, he had to be ripped off.
He had to be killed.
Out of the side of his eye, a quick glance. Okay, killed. Bob could feel Nadia's eyes lock on him suddenly, her head cock a bit.
That way, he couldn't ever say he paid off Marv, and no one else could either. Marv uses the money to cover all the holes. He cleans up his act. It's like it never happened. So, that's what we did.
You did. Eric barely in the conversation, but some warning in his head starting to sound. his head turning from the clock toward Bob.
"Killed him in my basement," Bob said. "Know what his name was?"
"I wouldn't know, Bob."
"Sure you would. Richie Whelan."
Bob reached under the bar and pulled out the 9mm. He didn't notice the safety was on, so when he pulled the trigger, nothing happened. Eric jerked his head and pushed back from the bar rail, but Bob thumbed off the safety and shot Eric just below the throat. The gunshot sounded like aluminum siding being torn off a house. Nadia screamed. Not a long scream, but sharp with shock. Eric made a racket, falling back off his stool, and by the time Bob came around the bar, Eric was already going, if not quite gone. The overhead fan cast thin slices of shadow over his face. His cheeks puffed in and out, like he was trying to catch his breath and kiss somebody at the same time.
"I'm sorry, but you kids," Bob said. "You know, you go out of the house dressed like you're still in your living room. You say terrible things about women. You hurt harmless dogs. I'm tired of you, man."
Eric stared up at him, winced like he had heartburn. He looked pissed off, frustrated. The expression froze on his face like it was sewn there, and then he wasn't in his body anymore. Just gone. Just shit. Dead. Bob dragged him into the cooler. When he came back, pushing the mop and bucket ahead of him, Nadia still sat on her stool. Her mouth was a bit wider than usual, and she couldn't take her eyes off the floor where the blood was, but otherwise she seemed perfectly normal.
"He would have just kept coming," Bob said. "Once someone takes something from you and you let them, they don't feel gratitude. They just feel like you owe them more."
He soaked the mop in the bucket, wrung it out a bit, and slopped it over the main blood spot.
"Makes no sense, right? But that's how they feel. Entitled. And you can never change their minds after that."
She said,
"You just fucking shot him. You know?
Bob swirled the mop over the spot.
"He beat my dog."
The Chechens took care of the body after a discussion with the Italians and the mix. Bob was told his money was no good at several restaurants for the next couple of months, and they gave him 4 tickets to a Celtics game. Not floor seats, but pretty good ones. Bob never mentioned Nadia, just said Eric showed up at the end of the evening, waved a gun around, said to take him to the office safe. Bob let him do his ranting, do his waving, found an opportunity, and shot him. And that was it. End of Eric, end of story. Nadia came to him a few days later. Bob opened the door, and she stood there on his stoop, with a bright winter day turning everything sharp and clear behind her. She held up a bag of dog treats.
"Peanut butter," she said,
her smile bright, her eyes just a little wet.
"With a hint of molasses."
Bob opened the door wide and stepped back to let her in.
"I've got to believe," Nadia said. "There's a purpose. And even if it's that you kill me as soon as I close my eyes."
"Me? What? No," Bob said. "Oh, no."
"Then that's okay. Because I just can't go through any more of this alone. Not another day."
"Me too." He closed his eyes. "Me too."
They didn't speak for a long time. He opened his eyes, peered at the ceiling of his bedroom.
"Why?"
"Huh?"
"This. You. Why are you with me?"
She ran a hand over his chest, and it gave him a shiver. In his whole life, he never would have expected to feel a touch like that on his bare skin.
"Because I like you. Because you're nice to Cassius."
"And because you're scared of me?"
"I don't know. Maybe. But more the other reason."
He couldn't tell if she was lying. Who could tell when anyone was, really? Every day you ran into people, and half of them, if not more, could be lying to you.
Why? Why not?
You couldn't tell who was true and who was not. If you could, Lie detectors would never have been invented. Someone stared in your face and said, I'm telling the truth. They said, I promise. They said, I love you. And you were going to say what to that? Prove it?
He needs a walk.
Huh?
Cautious. He hasn't been out all day.
I'll get the leash.
In the park, the February sky hung above them like a canvas tarp. The weather had been almost mild for a few days. The ice had broken on the river, but small chunks of it clung to the dark banks. He didn't know what he believed. Cassius walked ahead of them, pulling on the leash a bit, so proud, so pleased, unrecognizable from the quivering hunk of fur Bob had pulled from a barrel just 2.5 months ago. 2.5 months. Wow. Things sure could change in a hurry. You rolled over one morning, and it was a whole new world. It turned itself toward the sun, stretched and yawned. It turned itself toward the night. A few more hours turned itself toward the sun again. A new world every day. When they reached the center of the park, he unhooked the leash from Cassius's collar and reached into his coat for a tennis ball. Cassius reared his head. He snorted loud. He pawed the earth. Bob threw the ball, and the dog took off after it. Bob envisioned the ball taking a bad bounce into the road. The screech of tires, the thump of metal against dog. Or what would happen if Cassius, suddenly free, just kept running? But what could you do? You couldn't control things.
The Place Where He Belongs, written by Jim Fusilli and narrated by Mark Vitor. Beacon Hill.
After nearly 20 years at the United Nations, his wife was offered a position with Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she was thrilled. He was not. Jeff, are you sure you're all right leaving here? She asked. What could he say? A fair-minded man would acknowledge she'd sacrificed for his career. During the first week in town, they were invited to a cocktail party in Cambridge. How long had you lived in New York? Inquired one of her new colleagues. 49 years, he replied. And you are... 49, he said, scratching his 2-day growth. Oh, my goodness, said the man's wife. I wonder what you'll make of us. When they were leaving, the host called him Joe. They settled over by the Museum of Science, and he explored the music clubs, the D's and T.T. the Bears, mostly. He went to shows at the Orpheum, where he had opened for Jesse Colin Young long ago, and concerts at the colleges and at Berkeley, roaming by himself while Maya prepared for her lectures. A few musicians he worked with in the 80s played the garden, and he walked over, hunched and shivering in a biting wind as he crossed the Charles. Backstage, hugs all around, and, what are you up to? You know, he shrugged. He called Club Passim and asked if he could do a set or two. Thank you, no. Soon Maya said they were better suited to Beacon Hill, near where several of her colleagues lived, and she found a condo on Beacon Street, 2 floors in a brownstone built in 1848, the former French consulate, reasonably priced by Manhattan standards, an investment in a down market, and with space for his music room. Your call, he said, since he'd made only $6,200 in royalties in the previous year. She said that she felt revitalized by the new city, that Harvard was a miracle of intelligence and discourse. She was learning and having fun. He noticed that she no longer asked if he wanted to go back to New York. Boston was becoming her home, while he felt he'd been exiled. With little else to do, he soundproofed an upstairs bedroom and brought in his equipment, his upright piano, his guitars, a classic Fender bass, his old reel-to-reel tape recorder, mics and stands, cables and silver tape. He put baffle over the windows, his old Persian rug on the floor. His platinum album went downstairs in the living room. The label had sent one to every songwriter who contributed to the Grammy-winning soundtrack album. His tender love song was performed at weddings, and even people with little interest in pop music knew the words he'd written. This went on for years, the money rolling in. Then a comedian did a version on Letterman, mugging it up as he serenaded a pig in a straw bonnet. No one took the song seriously from then on. You couldn't listen to the original version without thinking of the comedian, his rubbery face, squealing voice, and the damned pig. In time, his publisher dropped him. Who'd sing any tune written by a man whose music was so easily ridiculed? Fortunately, they'd set aside enough money for their son to finish at Stanford. His wife had preached frugality even in his best years. Before the chaos of his sudden acclaim, they'd planned on having more children. They tried even when it seemed too late. Beacon Hill was unbearable. He couldn't find its rhythm, couldn't recognize the cues. He was out of place, and nothing he did made him feel any better. Daily life was a relentless series of insults and indignities. People were smug and complacent. Common courtesy didn't exist. No one said hello or thank you or held open a door. His wife, a temperate soul, couldn't disagree completely when he said there was something odd and off-putting about the place. A cleaner on Charles Street misplaced two of her suits for 9 days and never apologized. She'd ordered a case of wine for a party at their apartment, and it never arrived. "Service isn't a priority," she concluded. He couldn't find plantains at the grocer's, and the bagels sucked. No one knew what he'd done. She loved her job and called the neighborhood a walker's delight. The townhouses, antique shops, Acorn Street, the esplanade on the Charles, the way the sun shone when spring finally arrived. She took his arm as they crossed the Salt and Pepper Bridge, sailboats gliding below. After Maya went to bed, he'd walk across to the public garden, his guitar and case in hand, hoping something would come to him. In Washington Square Park, he'd have drawn a crowd. Here, nobody cared. During the day, he'd slip into a t-shirt, tug on jeans, and bring a sandwich to a bench where he'd watch swans drift on the lake. Nearby were flowers and nannies with cheery babies running on chubby legs. He'd smile, nod, but no one responded. In New York, he'd meet friends for lunch. He'd see people on the street. Everybody was open and welcoming. "Hey, Jeff," they'd shout. Here there was no refuge, no place to hide. He was a balloon drifting toward the high, boundless sky. Staring at his platinum album, he saw his gaunt, ghostly reflection and was surprised to find he was still there. "Did you hear about the baby?" Maya said as she hung up her skirt. He shook his head. "I didn't go out." She was going to ask if he heard it on the radio, but he'd become completely disengaged. He'd even stopped streaming WNYC. "A baby is missing. Stolen." She came to him with a flyer she'd been given at the Charles Street tea station. It said the baby was taken in the public garden yesterday. She had been sitting in a stroller over by the Make Way for Ducklings statue. So many children were laughing and playing. One fell and cut a knee on the cobblestone. When a nanny rushed over to help, leaving the infant stroller for a moment, "You could jump into a car and be on 90 to New York in 5 minutes," he said. "They're looking for people who are in the park to help. Good luck." He had it in his mind Beacon Hill wouldn't piss on somebody if he was on fire. He didn't believe her when she said it wasn't Beacon Hill's fault, reminding him that he'd struggled for the past few years in New York. He went to his studio while she made dinner, salmon and a cold rice dish she'd picked up on Charles Street. When he came down, she was pouring Pinot Grigio as she read a working paper on the fair trade movement. After they ate, he brought the dishes to the sink. Soon soap bubbles rose and popped. "Jeff, are you coming?" He grabbed a towel. "Where?" "To the vigil, remember? Everybody's helping with the baby." "These people..." "Stop it," she said. "I'm going. I wish you would." "I've got work," he told her. "I'll be upstairs." After he brought the trash to the basement, he walked outside and stood on the steps. Over in the public garden, hundreds of people were fanned out, studying the grass and grounds, looking into the tulip beds, hoping for a clue, any tidbit of information, a revelation. Klieg lights police had stationed on the pathways shed an eerie glow throughout the park, and there were long, quivering shadows. Kids in shorts and hoodies served cold drinks. An uncomfortable silence and an unsettling sense of dread filled the early summer air. Maya was over by the Angel of the Waters, the statue that reminded him of one with the same name in Central Park, and she was chatting with a thick, busty blonde. As the other woman lectured, Maya folded her arms, solemnity on her face. When she spotted him, she beckoned him with a wave, but he pointed upstairs and made a little gesture like he was strumming a guitar. Then he went back inside. "I'm onto something," he said when she returned. Don't be surprised if I don't come to bed. He held up a cloth sack she'd gotten at the Museum of Fine Arts that he'd filled with snacks and something to drink. Jeff, she said as she kicked off her flats, look at this. Another flyer, a sketch by a police artist. It looks like you, Jeff. No, it doesn't, he said as he nudged it back toward her. Gail McDermott thought so. Gail McDermott, the blonde on the first floor, runs a PR agency. He didn't know anyone in the building. No, he said, tapping the flyer. That guy is old. He's half bald. Scruffy. It's not me. I didn't say it was you. I'm going upstairs. They're going to drag the lake tomorrow, she told him. Walking away, he said, she's not dead. He couldn't keep the baby in his music room. It was as dark as a cave, and the soundproofing left the air stagnant and stale. He'd changed her and fed her and burped her and held her, tickled her chin, combed her downy hair with his fingers, bathed her with warm water with a face cloth, cooed at her, sang to her, played little figures on the piano. But the carton he converted to a bassinet was stupid, and she needed sunlight. So he brought her downstairs into the kitchen and sat with her on his lap by Maya's basil plants and thyme leaves. Hey, baby, he said as he cuddled her in his arms. Out on Beacon Hill, people had pulled their chins out of the air and were treating each other with decency and humility. They had a cause bigger than themselves now, something beyond parading their imaginary status, or so he assumed. He hadn't left the apartment grounds since he took baby Alice. Remembering that a few residents in the building didn't retrieve their globe until the day's end, he brought her to the center of the king-sized bed, nestled her on goose down, and took the creaking spiral staircase to the lobby. As he started back up, the globe under his hand, he heard the baby cry and hurried back to scoop her in his arms. He said, "It's all right, baby. Everything's all right." He bounced her and rubbed her back until she sighed and stopped fussing. He kissed her moist cheek. Down in her office in apartment 3, statue still and silent, sat Gail McDermott, who, though she tried, couldn't convince herself she hadn't heard a baby's cry. Fresh cup of coffee in hand, she lifted the flyer with the police sketch from her inbox, and, yeah, it did look like Maya's husband, that New Yorker who was some sort of musician, the odd, scowling guy who dressed like a teenager and looked like he needed something no one could provide. Jim, she called as she knocked again. Jim? He opened the door a crack. It's Jeff, he said. Jeff. Gail McDermott introduced herself by handing him a business card. I heard a baby. Not here. He scanned the card. McDermott Communications, it read. Specialists in crisis management. The building's address was printed below. Do you have the baby? Do I have... McDermott pushed in, and he watched as she surveyed the living room. Plain, plump, and round-faced, she wore business slacks and a snug white silk blouse. No makeup, her hair tucked behind her ears, flip-flops and a PDA on her belt. No baby here, Jeff said, standing by the door. I could have sworn. What's this? She stared at the platinum album, framed on the wall. I love this movie. Wait, you wrote this song? That song. The one with the pig, he thought. Yeah. That was my sister's wedding song. She turned. That's a beautiful song. Wicked beautiful. Thank. Upstairs, baby Alice let out a cry. He sank as he realized he'd left the door open to his soundproof studio. Oh, Jeff, McDermott said, puffing up. Maya and Jeff, the baby in his lap, faced McDermott, who sat behind her desk, the angel of the waters in the public garden over her shoulder. Like Jeff, she'd converted a bedroom to a workspace. Why? Maya repeated. He said, I don't know why. Was she in danger, Jeff? McDermott asked. No, she was asleep. Tell me what you were thinking. He shrugged. I wasn't thinking. I don't know, reacted. To what? Maya asked. Is a man who no longer matters supposed to understand why he did something? I don't know, really, he replied truthfully. He looked down at the baby, who slept peacefully. "Here, Maya," he wanted to say. "I'm sorry. Take her, and let's go home." But it was more, and much less, than that. "Ever do anything like this before?" McDermott asked. "No, of course not." "We need a lawyer," Maya said. "I'll get you one," McDermott replied, holding up a blunt index finger. "But let's think this through." She'd wriggled politicians, businessmen, and academics out of worse situations than this. Had the Patriots listened to her, the nation wouldn't think of them as cheaters. Had Larry Summers, he'd still be president of Harvard. She rubbed her temples. Stealing a baby from a stroller could seem a low thing. It had to be spun right. The guilty party had to define the crime. "It was an impulse," Jeff said. "So this is what you do in New York. You have an impulse and you steal a baby." He hung his head. "Have you called the police?" Maya asked. She was still stunned, the morning a blur since she was pulled from the lecture hall. "That's not at the top of our agenda," McDermott replied. "We have to inculcate Jeff here." "Are you saying we sneak the baby back into the park?" Maya asked. "We could do that," McDermott replied. "But how does that help him?" Maya frowned. "For one, he may stay out of jail." "That's the minimum outcome," McDermott said as she stood. "We can do better than that." Jeff brushed the baby's hair from her forehead. "Why does he take her?" McDermott said as she started to pace. "He's distressed. His career in shambles. No one acknowledges him. He has a sort of psychotic breakdown. Do I have that right, Jeff?" "Just about," he admitted. Maya looked at her husband, surprised he'd said it aloud. "Or he's committed an act of civic disobedience against Beacon Hill. He feels a smugness, a starchiness, a lack of soul. He's worried the child will grow up with a distorted sense of self. She'll be ill-equipped for life outside a tiny, out-of-touch neighborhood in a dynamic city, a great nation." Maya turned as McDermott circled behind her. "You don't believe that, do you?" she asked. "There's less pretension on Rodeo Drive," answered McDermott, who had grown up in the 9th Street projects. "No, I mean, you can't believe the police will accept that as an explanation." "The police will be easy," McDermott said. "Getting your husband back on top of the music business is the trick." "I never was on top, actually." Jeff stared at baby Alice. He wondered what their daughter might have looked like if ambition hadn't gotten between his word and Maya and their son. "Go shower and shave, Jeff," McDermott said as she returned to her desk. "Maya, get over to Newbury Street and buy him some grown-up clothes. I'll watch the baby." As she sat, she added, "By the way, I get $500 an hour, and you're on the clock until this is done." Okay, then. 2 in the morning, and Jeff was in his spot, his guitar on his lap, his fingers on the steel strings. The Angel of the Waters hovered over him, wings open, arms outstretched. Cast as far as he could see, the park was splendid under a starry summer sky, the flowers asleep until dawn. In the near distance, a policeman patrolled on horseback. He strummed a minor chord. Another. What? Was that a baby's cry? He put the guitar on its case, walked to the dry, shallow fountain at the foot of the statue, and, oh my God, there was a baby. The missing baby. Baby Alice. He scooped her up, nestled her in his arms, and dashed to Beacon Street. There wasn't a car in sight. Damn. Plan B. He raced to their building and rang every bell. Someone answered, a man with a high, flowery voice. "I found the baby," Jeff said hurriedly into the speaker. "The missing baby! I found it! Call the police!" McDermott, in plaid pajama bottoms and a big pappy t-shirt, reached him first, and by the time Maya rushed downstairs in her robe and slippers, most of the building was in the lobby, waving at the baby, patting Jeff on the back. "Look, Maya," he said breathlessly. "She was in the park, under the statue." "It's a miracle," she muttered. "She doesn't look hurt," McDermott said, peering over Maya's shoulder. Jeff nodded. He was crisp in new green khakis, a striped shirt from Brooks Brothers, and boating shoes, his hair combed, the part where it should be. For a moment, he drifted deep into the story McDermott had concocted. He felt like a man who'd done something worthwhile. Wanting no part of the charade, Maya left to retrieve his guitar. The police came. Two squad cars, burly guys in uniforms. The Herald beat the Globe.